Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Mary Eberstadt with us. Mary is, of course, well known to First Things readers, one of our favorite authors, if we listen to what our readers say. I'll just give the books. Mary's known so well. I'll just give books that you've written, a very prolific author. She wrote How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. That's from 2014. Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. That was a year before. And then a book that maybe that was a breakout book for you, Mary, giving you a very wide audience, Home Alone America, Why Today's Kids Are Overmedicated, Overweight, and More Troubled Than Ever Before, 2005. And I would say the thesis of that book probably holds even more today than it did 15 years ago. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, today's topic is another book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. It's out with Templeton Press. And I'm going to jump right in, all right, because that subtitle really gets to the thesis. And this is the first sentence in Chapter 2. The chapter's called A New Theory. And this is really going to lay out, I think, in a nice condensed fashion, what is the core thesis of the book. Our macro politics have become a mania about identity because our micro politics are no longer familial. How would you explain that?
Well, first, I'd like to say that this book is very countercultural because its argument is not the standard conservative argument about identity politics. The standard argument is really not an argument. It's just to dismiss identity politics as the product of helicopter parenting or snowflakes on campus, etc. But I disagree. I think in identity politics, we see the really signature political movement of our time that tells us where we are as a civilization better than any other phenomenon. It's no secret that Americans are at each other's throats in the public square. It's no secret that most people would agree we are more divided than ever before. The question is why? And we know that a lot of explanations are out there for why this is so. Some people say that it's Trump, and some people say that it's the patriarchy. Some people say it's the gender binary. We have all of these explanations. My explanation is new, and it is that the sexual revolution, 60 years into the experiment that is the sexual revolution, we are living in ways that are radically at odds with what we are meant to be as social creatures, as social animals. Families are smaller, families are scattered, divorce, abortion, fatherlessness, all of these trends that have skyrocketed since the 1960s now define the way most of us live. And it's in part just a matter of arithmetic, Mark, because what all of these trends have done is to subtract the number of people who have your back, the number of people in your family, literally, who can be counted on to watch out for you. And so the result, I argue, is that deprived of this primal identity, this relational identity that develops within family and extended family, many people are just cast adrift. And they are looking elementally and with panic for substitute collective identities. For a lot of people, we have to understand this, the only identity they feel secure about is now a political identity. So what I'm trying to do in the book is explain how we got to this divisive place and what we've lost that has brought us here.
You know, you make a striking point later on in the book on what has been lost. When you say political identity just now is the most secure identity they have. Well, one thing, how fluctuating and insecure are politics themselves? I mean, you can imagine in the 2016 election, if political identity is all you've got and you're young and you've really only known the presidency of Barack Obama, in any way, and you're certain that Hillary Clinton is going to follow the perfect man, would be followed by the first woman, and then, you know, the inconceivable happened. Well, what do you have to fall back on? You don't have family so much to fall back on. You don't have your church. You don't have other realities that are so solid. And when you put it this way, in the book, you're talking about identity politics and the cry of cultural appropriation, for instance, which strikes so many outsiders as really just kind of silly tantrum by spoiled kids on college campuses. But here's how you say, when the students or the young social justice warriors say, do not culturally appropriate, that's mine, you can't take that from me, you say, the evidence is impressionistic, but maybe that cultural scream of mine is coming from people who did have something taken from them, whether individually or collectively, something more substratal than the totemic objects now functioning as figurative blankies for lost and angry former children. Maybe the furor over appropriation reveals the true foundation of identity politics, which is pathos.
Yes, Mark, that really goes to the heart of the argument, and that's what's new about it. I think the sadness of identity politics has not been correctly identified. When you watch these demonstrations on campus and you see people duct taping their mouths shut and stamping their feet like toddlers, and sometimes crying, when you see this level of emotiveness, you realize this is not like the civil rights demonstrations. This is not even like the anti-war demonstrations of the 60s. This is something new. It is an expression of collective irrationalism and emotion that is not like anything that's gone before. And why is it there? Again, let's talk about what's been lost in the matter of identity. It's not only the case that defining myself via my family relations is more complicated than it used to be. And in the book, I get into this a little bit with evidence about children of divorce and their identity issues, children of anonymous sperm donation, et cetera, and their identity issues. Leaving that evidence aside, what's been lost is not only my ability to say who I am with reference to my family. There's also my ability to say who I am in religious terms. In many ways, this book is the flip side of How the West Really Lost God, where I looked at what the sexual revolution was doing to the churches. In this book, we're looking at what it's doing to politics. So the traditional Christian and other religious believers answers that question, who am I, very simply. I am a child of God. It's that simple. It's not about my sex. It's not about my skin color. It's not about other accidental attributes. I am a child of God is my identity if I'm a Christian. And in this day and age, a lot of people, especially young people, don't have access to that answer either. So the two main ways of defining identity up until now by reference to God and family have been taken away from them. No wonder they're frantic.
And I mean, why not people understand just the pure emotional comfort that goes with being able to say, I am a child of God, or all of us are equal in the eyes of God. That right there, it's foundational, right? It's firm, it's stable. The modern world is chaotic, and the internet has produced all forms of, you know, ephemeral intensifications of everything passing by. People need grounds, right? They need solidity. They need fathers, they need mothers, they need families, they need neighborhoods, they need the Lord as well. And why is it that so many, let's just say secularists, don't understand what is lost when you tear those things down?
Well, there's a great resistance if the sexual revolution is the locus of this problem. Sorry. There's a great resistance. If the sexual revolution is indeed the locus of this problem, then most people are not going to want to address it because most people have made their peace with this thing. But that's not to say it isn't generating system-wide problems of a kind that humanity has never had to wrestle with before. The demise of the churches and the demise of the family are very tightly linked. And let's put it in familial terms. At exactly the same time that fewer people have siblings to call their own, for example, families are smaller and smaller. Fewer people have brothers and sisters, let alone large extended networks. At exactly the same time, the diminution of Christianity means that they also have fewer figurative brothers and sisters. That's something that religious people take for granted. You're my brother. You're my brother in Christ. Or, you know, we are figurative brothers and sisters because we're all children of God. So people who now grow up without either of these things have lost basic building blocks of identity.
Do you find that a lot of the pressures that fall upon young people at selective college campuses aggravate this problem in a strange way, not just simply adding the pressure of achieving, but finding themselves in such a competitive environment, and they're away from their families. They're in this campus world that tries to create this machinery of safety that talks to the students constantly about triggering and microaggressions and showing respect and so on, but somehow it doesn't palliate their emotional pressure. It just isn't working. And that the answers that we try to come up with institutionally are simply no substitute for the family. They're no substitute for the church.
I think that machinery that you're talking about, that political correctness monster with all of its strict codes, is a very interesting phenomenon that also proves my point. These codes have arisen on campus because the old ways of restraining behavior, particularly male behavior, by reference to traditional rules and the traditional religious rule book, say, these no longer apply. And at some subliminal level, I think everybody in authority on the campuses and the students understand that it's a state of nature out there. So they keep trying to devise these playbooks that will restrain behavior and restore civility, not understanding that the problem is coming from a much deeper place. When I think about kids on campus today, and I think about the demographic changes of the last few decades, what I see are people who are coming into college far less socialized than their forebears were. And what I mean by that is that the family is where social learning takes place. And you know, Mark, I've got a fair amount of research in the book about animal behavior, that is non-human animals, for the reason—
I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. Yes.
For the reason that I think it's important. So kids are coming to campus without having grown up in an extended network with familial members of the opposite sex, which is how most of us learn about the opposite sex in the first place. They haven't had that petri dish. And so they're thrown into this campus situation with these rules that are meant to help them, but that are poor substitutes for better, older ideas.
So the campus administrators, they're trying to address a real problem. It's not a fake problem. It's not as many on the conservative side just want to reduce it to, you know, liberal bias or snowflakes, as you said, or so on. It's a real, genuine human need that is somehow being covered over with the tantrums that you see, the videos that you get are so easily sensationalized. But we have to go back to these kids' real lives and their inability to answer a question that you highlight so powerfully: who am I? I mean, that who am I question, that's the question, right? That's the ancient question. That's the reflective question. That's what the ancient Greeks said: who am I? What am I? This is, in other words, you're saying that young people are suffering an age-old problem in fixing themselves existentially in the world.
Yes, and it's registering in the empirical world. That is to say, for years now, clinicians and doctors and others have been chronicling the rise of psychiatric problems among the young. These include anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, and everything else that we now kind of take for granted. Again, where is this coming from? I locate the origin of this distressing rise in psychiatric trouble in the sexual revolution and the fact that it has left people unable to answer that essential question about who they are, what they're about, and what they're for on this planet.
Why can't we all just be free and independent souls, selves? Mary, why can't we all just be lone wolves?
Well, that's a great question.
because this gets to the beginning of the book,
yeah,
which the introduction is called The Myth of the Lone Wolf.
I led with the animal behavior research because I think it is both disarming to readers who might resist the argument and because I think it's very, very important. So during the last 10 years especially, science has handed us some amazing information about the inner workings of animals. And I'm talking primarily about mammals, but also this applies to others in the animal kingdom. To a degree that was never before understood, animals are intensely familial. The wolf is an excellent example. We have this phrase, the lone wolf, and we use it unthinkingly, when in fact, research on wolves during the last 10 years especially shows that there is no such thing as the lone wolf. Wolves live like Ozzie and Harriet. Wolves live in tight nuclear families, sometimes with members of extended family, mom, dad, children, siblings, and like all other animals, they live this way because that is how they learn to be what they are. So, to put the matter conversely, in a series of horrible experiments during the 1950s on rhesus monkeys, the opposite point was proven. If you take monkeys away from other monkeys, they cannot learn to be monkeys. If you isolate them, they develop autistic syndrome and nervous habits and other problems that seem very parallel to what we're seeing in the young these days. And it was even shown that rhesus monkeys who could see other monkeys but not touch them also developed autistic syndrome. So what does this tell us about what it means to be a social animal? It tells us that we are not born knowing how to be human beings. We learn that. We learn that from those around us, starting in the community of the family. And if we don't have that, we can't learn the way we're supposed to. So getting back to the example of the animals, it's been seen with elephants and monkeys that those raised in isolation from their own kind can't do the things that you would think come naturally. The isolated monkeys couldn't mother, for example, because they had never witnessed the example of mothering. These are well-known facts in the scientific world, at least among people who study animal behavior. And my point is that they are highly suggestive of what's been going on with humanity since the 1960s, since we stopped being surrounded by these kinds of networks of people from whom we learn. So we are more illiterate and more imperiled about what we're doing in the world than people were, I think, ever before in history.
I can't imagine how people can ignore that fundamental truth that says it is very hard for young men, for boys, to grow up to be men if they don't have fathers who are going to teach them how to be men, who are going to show them how to be men. And it's baffling to me how the evidence can be so strong. I mean, how much cognitive dissonance must afflict people who have a certain feminist outlook about mothers not needing husbands to help them raise their children against the mountains of evidence running against this. Maybe I should shift the question, Mary. How long is it going to take before the wages of the sexual revolution get to be so costly that we can't ignore the damage that it has done?
In some ways, I think we're seeing a healthy renorming. I think people are just at the beginning of understanding what this phenomenon has done to us as a society, as individuals, and really as a species. One example of this renorming is that divorce is actually becoming less likely at the highest level of the socioeconomic ladder. That one is particularly interesting because a lot of people in that cohort are progressive. So we have the phenomenon that they live right, they live right but think left.
Exactly, and the problem is that they speak left as well in public. And this is one of Charles Murray's big points that upper 20%, they observe the bourgeois virtues. They live sort of socially conservative lives, but they will not tell the rest of the world, the rest of America, to do the same thing. And so the sexual revolution really doesn't. I mean, they're able to get through the costs of the sexual revolution. They've got whatever the Protestant work ethic or the delayed gratification, the sense of responsibility as parents not to let what the sexual revolution did to so many others affect them quite so much. And they're the ones who sort of lead the culture, right? And so is that formula just going to be able to carry on?
I thought there was another breakthrough, potential breakthrough in understanding the costs of the sexual revolution, and that was the Me Too movement.
You have chapter 6 has the subtitle How Me Too Reveals the Breakdown of Social Learning.
Yes, exactly, because look at that movement. I want to make 2 points about this quickly, but the first is what you see there is that men and women have ceased to understand each other. Predatory men know what predatory men want. But the women in this situation, many of them the products of elite education, and remember, Me Too is emanating primarily from progressive home base. I mean, it's Hollywood and it's the media. So these are sophisticated people, which is exactly my point. Sophisticated young women who apparently have been launched into the world with no protective coloration whatsoever. No one seemingly ever telling them, if your boss calls you to his hotel room in the middle of the night, don't go. Or no one seemingly telling them, you know, this kind of behavior is over the line, and if it happens to you, you need to report it.
Well, one of the things that first struck me when hearing about the Harvey Weinstein cases and other cases, especially with young aspiring women, where were their brothers? Where were their fathers? Where were their close boyfriends or fiancés, whatever? Where were the other men in their lives?
I had exactly the same thought, Mark. And I read through more accounts than I would like to think of these cases for that very reason. And the answer is these women don't seem to have had such men in their lives. I found no mentions of fathers or brothers or cousins or uncles. Once in a while, a boyfriend would turn out in retrospect to have been protective, to have, you know, interfered in the situation, told the other guy to back off or whatever. But it was stunning how something that, again, the animal kingdom takes for granted, that, you know, protective males will act protectively when females are threatened, this wasn't happening there. So Me Too is, I think, an extreme example of showing the contradictions that we now find ourselves in and the just basic emotional illiteracy that's out there. And it still stands a chance, I think, of registering on people as an example that might change their minds about the sexual revolution and its toll.
Let me mention something that Camille Paglia said a while back when, it was actually after Donald Trump was elected, where she said that one of the things that has happened in the wake of the sexual revolution, which she celebrates a lot of the anarchic sides of it, although she always believes that it should have been contained, but she said that with the sexual revolution, what has actually happened is that men and women have become less interested in the sexuality of one another. You talked about predatory men are interested in what predatory men want. But that before this, that young men were sort of fascinated and in a way intimidated by the sexuality of women. It was a great, powerful, mysterious force that they encountered, and also vice versa as well, and that the polarization actually made a certain kind of high respect or at least consideration of the other sex's sexuality. But with the sexual revolution, all the freedom and the liberation and the pornography that followed, actually there is a lot less interest in the sexuality of the other person than there was before. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think that we face a paradox here, which is that the most sexually experienced generations in history are also the most sexually illiterate that way. And again, it goes back to not having learned what the opposite sex is about in community, in the community of a church, the community of a home, the community of civic engagement, which, as Robert Putnam showed, has also been declining. So when I look at these phenomena like the 71 gender identities, the nonstop stories about gender in the news cycle, and people deciding they're one thing one day and one thing the next, this is no longer a surprise to me, because given how shattered the ecosystem is, it is no wonder that people can't answer the most basic questions about who they are and what they're about.
Let me come back to the book in our final minutes. You have part two of the book, and you have contributions from three people. Do you want to describe those three contributions?
Yes. So there are three comments on the argument from Rod Dreher, who was chosen for the obvious reason that he has covered some of this terrain and that he is a prolific, fascinating commentator on the decline of religion and the decline of the family. And the next contributor is Mark Lilla. Mark Lilla is, of course, the most prominent liberal who attacked identity politics and was attacked for that attack. He's a professor at Columbia University. He is immensely learned, and it was a great pleasure to include him in the book. Readers will see that he does not agree with a lot of what I say, but he disagrees with a civility that one rarely finds these days in public commentary. And then the third contributor is Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel had been in touch with me about my book, How the West Really Lost God. And when I wrote this, which I explain as a kind of flip side to that, I got in touch to see if he would like to contribute, because he is, among other things, the foremost student of the French-born philosopher René Girard. And Girard's work, as First Things readers will know, focuses intensely on the relational nature of human community. And so that made Peter Thiel a natural commentator as well. So the three of them...
One sort of a social conservative, one a liberal, one a conservative with some libertarian leanings.
Yes.
With Peter Thiel. Interesting trio.
And you'll see that not everyone buys into the thesis, but again, it was our hope to have these different perspectives, because we think that the argument is important, the argument about the primal nature of politics these days. And so we were hoping to fan the conversation out in different directions by having their perspectives brought into the book.
Great. One anticipation, you have an article coming out in the next issue of the magazine. It's actually a copy, a version of the speech you gave at the National Conservatism Conference under the title, Goodbye to So What? And just quickly, Mary, for our listeners and future readers, what is So What?
Well, I call it the creed of So What, because I think it's been the dominant ethos of our time, and under the creed of so what, a lot of things have been written off as acceptable collateral damage that shouldn't be acceptable collateral damage. I'm talking in the speech about the opioid crisis, for example, 400,000 people dead, it's not okay to look at that and say, well, we played by libertarian rules and this stuff happened and it was their fault and so what? And that's one of several examples that I give. But I would also add that the toll of the sexual revolution falls very much into that category as well. It's not okay to look at this as dominant liberals and conservatives do these days and just say, well, look, it's a fact of life and there's no getting around it, so just get over it and move on and don't pay attention to the damages out there. That's not acceptable anymore, I think. And the record increasingly shows why.
All right. The book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics, out with Templeton Press. Thank you, Mary.
Thanks for having me, Mark.